and underneath.
And it goes for real.
You've been talking about Sasquatches and Yetis.
Yellow, orange object straight ahead.
This is the Paranormal Report.
Welcome one and all to the Paranormal Report. Hey, I'm Micah Hanks, and hey, he is
Jim Harold. So glad to be with you once again, Micah, for a heaping helping of paranormal stuff. I mean, it's a lot of interesting stories, and the thing that I like about some of these stories, some things are maybe a little different than we usually cover, but still quite fascinating.
Yes, absolutely. You know, we've got a good roundup today, but first, before we get to business, as we tend to do on this slightly long-form audio show, so I hear you went and you got your coffee, and yes. as you got up from your chair to go and get your coffee, I went to go get coffee just as well. You know, and on my end, I'm mixing some nuts and some berries in with mine, not to necessarily improve the flavor, but just to make the coffee last a little longer. Do you remember that report that came out a while back, Jim? They were talking about how a lot of coffee, chemists determined that there was actually everything from dirt to tree bark to twigs and things like that.
I don't remember. I remember one of the various reports. Now it's good for you again. You know, a while ago it wasn't good for you, but it's good for you again is what I just heard. But I didn't know about the berries and the twigs.
Well, I don't know about berries. I say that so that I can play up my feral humanistic hunter-gatherer sensibilities. But no, seriously, chemists were utilizing techniques. For instance, I think what specifically they've done was liquid chromatography, which I've experimented with in my own kitchen with leaves and things like that because I'm a science geek. But they were able to determine that there was all kinds of stuff that was in ground coffee varieties. Now, do you grind your coffee at home?
No, I'm like the ugly American consumer here. I use K-cups.
Well, you know, it may not be all that bad. I've actually had a good experience with a lot of those guys and the Keurig machines. But I am a coffee snob. I grind my own at home. And folks, I maintain that you probably should just as well. So now with that, I don't know if there's anything mysterious about it, but I do think that when you got up to go get your cup of coffee, Jim, you caused an EMP burst.
There was so much friction from my chair that it traveled halfway across the country and shut off your electric.
Yeah, so we got a late start because, yes, my electricity went out the minute you got up to go get coffee. So you somehow created like an EMP shockwave.
Ooh, that's scary. I'm like the sun. Don't get too close. Don't look directly at me.
That's
might
right.
Fry your eyes. Well, yeah. From the hilarious to the unfortunate, this is a story that has a lot of human interest, even if there weren't a hint of the paranormal in it. Now, many of you have probably heard about this case that happened earlier this week from Spanish Fork, Utah. A woman and her son were found in a flipped vehicle. It was resting on its hood in the Spanish Fork River. Now, unfortunately, when this was found, the mother was deceased, but luckily they were able to rescue an 18-month-old girl, Lily. But what makes it appropriate for this show, and of course our hearts go out to that family, what a sad, sad thing. I guess they were coming home from a family meeting or something, a dinner or something, and went missing, and somebody found this car, the rescuers went. They may have never found it, but there was a mysterious voice emanating from the car. Officer Jared Warner, who works here in Spanish Fork, said, "We've gotten together and just talking about it. All four of us can swear that we heard somebody inside the car saying, 'Help.'" So to set the stage, you have this woman who is obviously at this point deceased and her 18-month-old baby trapped. These officers are looking for somebody. They're trying to find them, and they keep hearing, "Help, help." And it's a voice. But of course, it wouldn't make sense that an 18-month-old could do that. So who was this voice emanating from, Micah? Again, one of these weird things, and again, you're talking about four police officers who are saying they all heard it. So it's not something they made up, and they kept hearing, "Help." Where was that voice coming from? I mean, it kind of boggles the mind, doesn't it?
Yeah, to say the least. This story, I believe, if not late on Sunday, broke on Monday morning. And so I did my live Graylian report that night and read this story. I was very peripherally familiar with it prior to going to air because it was a last-minute addition to our roundup. And even my skeptical co-host, Chris Hayes, there was very little said after this story, and we all were just kind of like, "My God, what do you make of that?" But I'll tell you this, Jim. You know, we tied it in a little with the idea of the third man factor. Are you familiar with that?
Yes. Yes, yep. I am familiar with it, where mountain climbers or something, they will hear, maybe if they're in danger or something, they will hear a guiding voice.
Yeah, or in some instances, it doesn't necessarily just involve, you know, auditory, what many take to be hallucinations.
They feel a presence.
They'll either, yeah, sometimes they get the, for instance, Ernest Shackleton had even described the sense where he and two companions had felt that there was a fourth person. And interestingly, the way that they tie this in was that there was, I believe it was a T.S. Eliot poem that described that experience and the belief of a third man being there. And what I think that the author, was his name John Geiger, I believe, that wrote this book about the third man factor. I hope I'm not getting all these facts wrong, because unfortunately I don't have them all directly in front of me. But the story goes that the poem had purportedly been inspired by Shackleton's experience, but that they had been misremembered that there were three men, and hence a fourth was remembered. And that expression, the third man factor, actually borrows from that poem, which misremembered it was actually a fourth man. Now, however you want to look at it, the idea here is that people who are in, yes, as you said, Jim, you know, they're in extreme existential threat or stress, tend to kind of externalize there being someone there helping them. One really interesting story involved a man who claimed that he was about to succumb to hypothermia and crouched down and tried to keep himself warm as he was, I think, trekking across the Himalayas. And at one point, he believes that he woke up and saw a strange shadowy figure mm-hmm. looming over him and shielding him, and he believed it was the Yeti. And, you know, Geiger would claim quite the contrary, that it was actually someone else. But now, or rather not someone else, but I mean the impression of there being a quote-unquote third man there, you know, this individual, which really in that case is just a second man, but I digress. Now, the point here is that it's easy to understand that psychologically a person who is undergoing a period of trauma or their sense of survival is kicking in, that they may externalize there being another person there that might help them. I understand that, but how do we explain in this case a child who couldn't have been calling for help, a mother who was deceased, and yet there are four police officers who all say that they heard a voice coming from what appeared to be within the car calling for help? That is incredible.
It is incredible, and the fact that there were four of them, I think, is really interesting. You are correct. It is John Geiger who wrote The Third Man Factor. Interesting, I remember very specifically, I heard a great interview of John Geiger by, of all people, Ian Punnett of Coast, formerly of Coast to Coast AM, had a great interview. And actually, I've tried to get Geiger on the show with no luck, but would love to have him on the program to discuss this. And it's one of those things where science touches the metaphysical. And the question is this science or is it metaphysical or is it a little bit of both? But again, I don't think these guys are lying. They all heard something. And the fact that they all heard it in the same episode is what really makes it interesting to me, because it wasn't just one person. One person you could explain away. Four people, assuming they're telling the truth and there's no reason to think otherwise, not so easy to explain away. So it does add to the mystery of this. Thank goodness that little baby was saved. Now, there has been a late-breaking update, and I don't have a lot of information on this, but apparently there were some drugs found in the car, including marijuana. So I guess they're going to do some toxicology on the mom and see if that had any impact. It is certainly not confirmed that it did, but obviously that raises an eyebrow when you see it. But either way, God bless us, this woman, and certainly this little baby is baby tries to go through life without her mom. And it just tugs at the heartstrings while at the same time puzzling our minds. And speaking of minds, there are some minds that are at odds with the National Geographic. And this gets into terminology and what we should call things and that thing that maybe some people would call political correctness. Tell us about it, Mike. It's interesting, a story you found.
Well, you know, I say this goes a little deeper because I think that the continuing narrative here is that we have news sources and television networks who are consistently blowing, I think, things out of proportion and blurring the lines between fact and fiction. And if not fact and fiction, at very least, they're sensationalizing overtly certain news items. Now, this week, what we're talking about is something that, again, you know, we featured this on the program last week on the Graylian Report, and I think that you and I have independently discussed it quite a bit, this discovery of a so-called lost city deep in mm-hmm. the jungles of Honduras. There was, as a matter of fact, just yesterday, another story about a possible second location that was discovered. But now The Guardian is reporting as of this morning that more than 24 archaeologists and anthropologists have apparently composed an open letter that they have sent. This is aimed at the at National Geographic. And they're protesting. They're more specifically claiming that sensationalization of their fields has been propagated by National Geographic. And they have been accused, Nat Geo, of reverting to a, quote, colonialist discourse in accounting researchers had found two city-like sites in the deep jungles of Honduras, one referred to, of course, as a lost city of a monkey god. Now, these archaeologists and anthropologists have also said that Nat Geo has been ignoring literally decades of research that suggests that Honduras was home to a vibrant chain of kingless societies, which merged qualities of the Maya to the north and other peoples, less stratified, more equal cultures. Now, these scholars, according to what The Guardian writes, quote, criticize National Geographic and the media for what they describe as the aggrandizement of a single expedition at the expense of years of research by scientists and decades of support from indigenous people of the dense rainforests in Honduras' Mosquitia region. And I think that the key point here is that, you know, again, they consider this as being a disrespect for indigenous knowledge. And hence, I guess it does get a little into political correctness. The idea that we can say that there's a lost city, the monkey god, newly discovered. Well, actually, there's been decades of research that's been ongoing that supports this, and most of it drawn from indigenous cultures and their knowledge. Now, I think that it's important that that not be overlooked. The broader narrative I see here, though, is that, yeah, sure, maybe there's been a little bit of, you know, again, I think the term that they used, aggrandizement. But, you know, National Geographic has often been considered, by virtue of the publication and then, of course, what followed, the television network, as being a source of more stable and respectable information. And I mean no disrespect, by the way, to the parties who played or who were involved in particular programming mm-hmm. that over the years, but to name one, UFO or Chasing UFOs, you know, I've got friends who were on that program. But by the same token, a lot of people had said that, you know, the way that, including the cast members of that show, there was a big stink about this. If you remember, James Fox was very unhappy with the way that they put that show together. Otherwise, respectable researchers were kind of put into a situation where they felt that the way that the program was edited and presented completely shot the entire thing in the foot. And really, it seemed more like National Geographic just trying to find a way to kind of, chime in on what history has done with ancient aliens, what discovery has done. With a number of what, you know, really, there's no way you can look at it other than to say that they have completely put out fantasy and tried to kind of tie it in with this viral, oh, well, maybe there's some truth to it. They've done this with the Dyatlov Pass story. They did it with a mermaid thing, a mega shark situation. You know, and a lot of people are saying these networks, you can't really take anything that they say without that proverbial grain of salt. And here we see it yet again with National Geographic in what otherwise seemed to be an actual serious and soberly reported news article. Apparently, archaeologists and anthropologists disagree. And it just goes to show, Jim, that really, I mean, the very best among our news sources, whether or not you consider National Geographic that, I still like reading stories there, but you know, they're really kind of falling short of the mark according to those in the academic community.
Well, it's interesting because, you know, one side of this, one side is the idea that they're disrespecting indigenous knowledge and the knowledge of the ancients and the people who live in that region as well. And the other charge is that they were engaging in colonialist discourse in the choice of their language. So that's where I brought in the political correctness thing. And I guess it's twofold. I have a personal peeve against everything. It's got to be politically correct. And I don't like to get into politics on the shows because I respect people of all political stripes, but that is something that I think is a bit of a danger to our culture in terms of, you know, certainly we shouldn't say anything that is sexist. We shouldn't say anything that's racist. But I think also you can go to the extent where you're charging political incorrectness at every turn. But that's, get me off my soapbox. But to your point, in terms of television, I think there's very little good television on the paranormal, on unexplained phenomena, very little. And I keep going back. It's sitting right there on my shelf. I'm looking at it now, and it was a little campy and it was a little cheesy, but I go back to something like In Search Of, where they just kind of interviewed the people and gave them, you know, their say, whether it was somebody like Stanton Friedman, or to a point I think you made when we talked about this, whether it was just some guy who saw a UFO. They didn't, you know, there was a little bit of, you know, well, could it be, you know, a little bit of that, but it was mainly straight ahead reporting. And in some ways, I guess we have ourselves to blame for that, because maybe people don't want that. Maybe people yelling at supposed ghosts get better ratings. So maybe we get the coverage that we deserve. But you're smarter than that, because you're listening to this show. And speaking of ghosts and all things ghostly, did you have anything else on that, Mike? Anything you'd like to tie up on that?
No, I didn't. Although I should just point out, again, a lot of people might look at that and say, okay, what does that have to do with the paranormal? Well, you know, when I touched on that story on my show the other night, again, there was this idea that one of these two sites might have been this lost city where there was a purported monkey god, a deity, and there's a famous photograph that's been in circulation that even The Guardian carried, where they said that the face on this stone, I guess, you know, what had one time been a part of a statue, but it's lying on the ground here. They'd said that they thought it might be a weird jaguar. And the idea here is that there was a deification in this city of not only a monkey god, which kind of parallels with the Hindu Hanuman, and also the ongoing reports of monkey-like, or, you know, therianthropic individuals, half human, half this or that, around the world. And, of course, that idea that a human could, by virtue of some magical process, become a human-animal hybrid, i.e. the skinwalker and things like that. So there's a bit of an interesting cultural parallel there that relates to this story, but the archaeological community has not been happy with the way it's been presented. So hence why we touch on that here on this show. And moving along, yeah, you do have this story, totally different subject, looking at Waverly Hills. That's a big one in the ghost, I loathe saying ghost hunting, Jim, but, you know, I mean, I think that, you know, in the paranormal community, most of us know what Waverly Hills is. So tell us the latest on this.
Well, apparently, now this is according to the folks at NJ.com, New Jersey, obviously, that apparently Waverly Hills Sanatorium in Kentucky, which is one of the most haunted locations in the country, ostensibly, and multiple TV shows have done specials from there. It turns out that now they are thinking about turning the hotel, turning it into a hotel and convention center. Apparently the plans include a 3,050 square foot restaurant, an 8,500 square foot conference center, 120 hotel rooms, and a museum focusing on the history of the hospital. Now, I have multifaceted questions on this. First of all, I don't really know the plan, so I don't know if the original structure is going to maintain as it is, and they're going to, it seems like to me, they're probably going to rehab the whole structure. So my question is, by doing that kind of renovation, if it is haunted, do you kind of suck the soul out of it, for lack of a better phrase? Yeah, I mean, basically by redoing the whole thing and making it this fancy hotel and conference center, do you destroy the very thing that people go to it for? And then I don't know if they have a plan to leave some of it undisturbed or what the plan is exactly. And secondly, is it disrespectful to the people who live there? We know that people in these types of facilities lived a very tough life. You know, in this particular story, they talk about the body chute that they used to dump bodies with when people died. So obviously they weren't treated very well. So is it disrespectful to the people who live there? And in essence, are we kind of making it a haunted Disneyland, you know, a haunted theme park? Is it the right thing to be doing? I'm not saying it is or it isn't. I'm just asking the question. What do you think, Micah?
Well, I know that in a similar instance here in Western North Carolina, actually more specifically in my hometown of Asheville, North Carolina, there had been a very famous sanatorium, you know, mental hospital that had been in operation many, many years ago. And today, the same location now is actually a a big, beautiful apartment complex in a rustic kind of location, and of course in a historic building. And I'll tell you, I went down in the basement when it was they had already begun to lease some of the apartments, but the building, when they begun leasing out the apartments that had been finished, many levels of the building, including the basement area, were still under reconstruction, I guess we would say, and renovation. And I had a friend who had moved in and who happened to be very, you know, influential and involved in the ghost hunting kind of community at the time. And he had said, you know, why don't you come up and, you know, I'll take you around one night, because as a, you know, as a person who's actually living here as a tenant, I can do that. And so I remember riding up and down the rickety old elevator on this building, and we went down to the bottom level, and walking through the basement, there had been, for instance, one of the areas where there had been a tiled wall, and this is where they would give, you know, some of the troublemakers the bath, which would be that they would be, you know, sprayed with a hose if they got up early. There was another area where you could see that there was kind of a solitary confinement, and I went over and looked at the wall, and I could see the hatch marks in the wall counting the days that someone had been, you know, sprawling into the wall with whatever they could find, I guess. And it was pretty interesting to think that they were changing this into, you know, apartments. And now there are people who have these luxurious homes. And I don't know if it's, I don't know how you'd look at that. I mean, I guess it could be considered a little troubling. You know, I think that in terms of real estate, you know, people would say, oh, all's fair in love and war. But, you know, by the same token, not only would it be a little eerie to live there yourself, some people may have issues if they had had a family member who had lived there, something along those lines. So I could see why with Waverly Hills and the popularity associated with that place over the years, that there would be some concern about something like that. And it is a little odd to me that we have these kind of locations that are fairly consistently transformed into you know, housing and luxurious, usually at that. It's pretty odd.
Yeah, I mean, it's kind of one of those tough questions. There's not an easy answer to it. On one hand, I can totally understand the local economy. It would be a boon to the local economy, probably put a lot of people to work. Certainly, I love the idea that they would have a museum dedicated to the history. I think that's pretty neat. But then you have to think, it's almost like building something over a graveyard. Is there a certain amount of respect that's being lost? I don't know the answer to it, but I thought it was an interesting question to ask. Someplace I've always wanted to visit. Hopefully I'll get there. And probably if I'm going to get there, I'd rather do it before the big revamp, so you can see it more as it was.
Yeah. Well, absolutely. Well, that's a pretty illuminating argument you make.
Yes, yes, indeed it is. But there's something even more illuminating in the West, and that's our next story, isn't it, Micah?
That's right. Yeah. California apparently this morning has begun sinking into the ocean. That's right. No, I'm kidding. But, you know, no joke, Jim. There is actually a study with regard to parts of Ireland where they're saying that there are levels, water levels rising incredibly quickly. They don't seem to show necessarily sea levels rising so much as, yes, parts of Ireland maybe that are actually sinking. Very, very interesting. I'll have to dig up that story. It didn't make the news roundup today, but as far as bright lights,
well,
to
wait, 1 minute. Since you mentioned Ireland,
yeah.
You know, it's probably pretty important that people get there while they still can. Aren't you going to Ireland?
Well, I am. And that's funny because Mark Brady, one of my newsies who sent that story to me, he said, I hope you get to go over there before. I think it's Connemara, actually, where these water levels are have been noticed to have apparently over the last few decades risen an extraordinary amount. He says, I hope you get to go see it before it's underwater. Well, this June, yes, I'm going to Ireland on the Ancient Megaliths and Sacred Spaces tour. John Ward, Scotty Roberts are going to be joining me. James Swagger, who I spoke to this morning just before our show. And, of course, Barry Fitzgerald, talking of ghost hunting. He's, of course, one of the famous stars of Ghost Hunters International. And so we're going to be taking a trek across Ireland together this June. And people, if they head over to ExodusRealityTours.com, you can actually sign up and go along. I'm trying to get Jim to go with me here. You know, I don't know what it's going to take to get Jim to go along, but, you know, I think we'd have a great adventure. So anyway, you know, that's something people can learn about. And yeah, I will be going, I guess that's a little further east for me, but you can learn about that at this aforementioned site. Now, headed back to the west,
yes.
It's not actually California sinking into the ocean. It's a bright light over Colorado that had really gotten the attention of a few people. And it turns out, according to, this is interesting because this is twice now on this program, Jim, that you and I've talked about a show or something on this show that had to do with UFOs that was reported by the Weather Channel.
Mm-hmm. And I love that. That's great.
Yeah. It's very interesting that they're chiming in on the whole UFO thing. Weather.com carried this article, and they said, bright light spotted over Colorado is no longer a mystery event. Here's the story. Okay, the American Meteor Society had originally listed in relation to a strange fiery object that had been seen flying across clear skies over Colorado's Front Range that they believed it was a mystery event. And the reason why is because they'd said that some witnesses, including Brian Paulson, who captured the video that is probably making the rounds on numerous sites by now that shows this object, they'd reported seeing this object for as long as 20 seconds. Hmm. And that is much longer than most meteors typically remain visible in the sky. So NASA took interest in this, Jim. They were quite interested in seeing what was going to happen. And they said that after investigation, that indeed they do believe that the fireball was a meteor and that it belongs to a class of space rocks known as Earthgrazers. According to NASA, an Earthgrazer can travel a considerable distance before getting low enough to completely burn up in Earth's atmosphere. And there were a number of people online who had seen this thing. They described it as being bright green and fading as it passed over the mountains. As a matter of fact, we have a couple of tweets. Brian Glasscock had actually said, huge meteor just streaked east to west over Castle Rock, Colorado. Greg Moore said huge fireball north to southwest of Vail passed over this morning. He also described it as bright green with a flaming tail. So while weather.com says this indeed was an Earth grazer and that this could be in the sky for as long as 20 seconds as people described, you know, it reminds me a little of back during the 1940s and 50s. Dr. Lincoln LaPaz and a few others had also been instrumental in this discussion around the times of those early UFO reports of what were described as green fireballs that were seen streaking through the skies. And in many instances, these green fireballs, they said, were apparently flying, you know, over a more of a like a horizontal kind of a path rather than streaking downward. And they would remain in the sky for a long time. And it makes you wonder if some of those green fireballs from the early days of ufology might not have been indeed the same sort of a phenomena that NASA and other agencies recognize today as being earth-grazing meteors.
You know, actually, and I don't know if I've ever said it on this show, I saw kind of a green fireball about, about 10 years ago, I would say, maybe a little longer. My wife and I were traveling down a main road where we live, and we looked up in the sky, and it looked like a green fireball. Now, I didn't equate it with being an ET or little green men or anything like that. I figured it was some kind of space phenomenon, but what kind of verified it for us is we were listening to a local talk radio station. And somebody called in just as we were seeing this and saying, oh, I'm at such and such a place and I'm seeing a green, like a fireball entering the atmosphere. Oh, and the host said, oh, you're drinking something, you're smoking something, hung up on the guy. And it was about, I mean, this was about, it was in the winter, as I recall. So it got dark early. So I think it was about like 6 o'clock at night. And I know we couldn't have been the only people who saw it. And this is in a major suburb of Cleveland, Ohio. So, yeah, these green fireballs, anytime I hear them, I'm like, ooh, interesting. I saw that myself. And again, I think it was space junk or a meteorite or something like that. I don't think there was anything paranormal about it, but it's a strange thing to see.
Huh. You know, I'll tell you, it's so funny that you mentioned that because I've had on two occasions myself, in the company of others, instances where I've observed green fireballs as well. Noah Falloon, a longtime friend of mine, and I were traveling south toward the Asheville airport one evening when we saw a bright green flash of light that lit up the entire sky accompanied by, I didn't see it because I was driving, but Noah had observed the green fireball streak across the sky that, you know, we didn't recall any sound that accompanied that, but it seemed that there was an explosive flash that literally did cause the entire sky to turn green. On another instance, much closer to ground. In fact, I was so amazed at what I was seeing that I was convinced that this thing probably smashed into a field and that there could have been meteorite debris recovered. Joshua P. Warren, the well-known commentator on all things paranormal, Joshua and I were traveling through the back roads together one night of Western North Carolina. Just he and I believe, again, on this instance, I was driving and Joshua was riding in the passenger seat. And as we were driving along near Leicester, North Carolina, we both saw a distinctly green fireball blazing through the sky. And this thing couldn't have been, Jim, maybe more than 100 yards above the ground. Mm-hmm. We were both just amazed by that. Now, again, there's nothing really anomalous about what causes a fireball or a meteor to glow green as it burns through our atmosphere. As a matter of fact, there are a lot of different chemical components or rather, I should say, physical components that can lead to this. According to the American Meteor Society, sodium, for instance, will produce a yellowish color. If you're going to see a green fireball, that's typically the presence of nickel. And if you see blue-white, which I think is a little more common, that's magnesium. But also they note that the velocity of the meteor also plays an important role since a higher level of kinetic energy will intensify those colors compared with others. So, you know, it's pretty interesting that we see these from time to time and that you've seen one and that I've seen one. And I think it's pretty absurd that we have a verifiable scientific phenomena here or something that can be understood through science that a radio host would shut somebody down for. That's pretty stupid, in my opinion. Oh, you've been drinking, Jim.
Well, yeah, it wasn't us. We didn't call him, but somebody else. So somebody else thought it was really just really, really, really strange. Now, you know, from time to time, Micah, people ask me, what is the thing that you have the biggest question about? What do you wonder about in terms of all these different phenomena? And I say, well, the big question is, what's it like to die? What happens? Well, the BBC says that there is a physician out there who has kind of an answer. And this is really interesting. We'll link in the show notes to this, as we always do at both of our individual sites, to all the source articles. And we always recommend you check out the source articles, to get the full story and also to give these folks some credit for the good work they've done. But they kind of buried the lead on this one, but Sam Parnia, he's a critical care physician and director of resuscitation research at Stony Brook University School of Medicine in New York, said, you know, all this speculation, I want to do a study. So he, along with colleagues from 17 different institutions in the US and UK, did a study. So for 4 years, they analyzed more than 2,000 cardiac arrest events. That's when a patient's heart stops and they're officially dead. Of those patients that they looked at, 16% were able to be brought back from the dead. And Parnia and his team were able to interview about 101 of them, about a third. And he said the goal was to try to understand, first of all, what is the mental and cognitive experiences of death. And it was interesting. They basically came down to seven different categories. One was fear. Another one was seeing animals or plants. Hmm. Number three was a bright light. We always hear about that one. Another one was violence and persecution. Another one was deja vu. The sixth one was seeing family. And then the seventh one was recalling events post-cardiac arrest. Now, that last one's, and actually in the story, they do a long write-up about one gentleman who actually died, and he was able to see the medical team working on him. And they were able to verify the things that he's saying that he should not have been able to see, that he was able to see the old floating up towards the ceiling and seeing people work on. He was able to specifically identify things that through standard biology, you should not be able to. But that was more of the exception rather than rule. They said that these experiences in the main were dreamlike or hallucinatory scenarios. And it says that it seems like the mental experience of death is much broader than what's been assumed in the past. So it's interesting, you know, so there were some not so happy things. You know, one person said, I had to get through a ceremony and the ceremony was to get burned. Then again, 22% reported a feeling of peace or pleasantness. Some saw living things, all plants, no flowers, or lions and tigers, while others basked in the glow of a brilliant light or reunited with family. So, Micah, I don't know that they've answered the questions, but they've opened up a lot more questions. And I really give this doctor and his team and the people that dealt with this a lot of credit. And he says, all of these things, what's a soul, what is heaven and hell, I have no idea what they mean, and there's probably thousands and thousands of interpretations based on where you're born or what your background is. He continues, it's important to move this out of the realm of religious teaching and into objectivity. So good on him and his team for doing this. I think it's to be applauded to take a serious scientific look at this, and I hope that they continue to do so.
Sure. And, you know, that may not in truth remove all the religious or spiritual components. I think a lot of people become very hesitant to accept this kind of an approach if they come from religious or a spiritual background, because sometimes these things are perceived as being an affront to that belief system, which it may not have to be that. I think it's important that scientifically we look at these kinds of, again, these sort of cultural and really, I would say, mythic staples that we see For instance, you mentioned people seeing plants and animals and things like that. During a lot of the sort of psychoactive experiences that have been described by people over the years, and I'm not just talking about like random drug users, I'm talking about clinical DEA-approved studies, the likes of which were carried out by Dr. Rick Strassman in the 1990s at the University of Arizona. We have a little, but not a whole lot because of the taboo nature of these subjects, of clinical data that can be attributed to the symbolic and the archetypal imagery that was present since time immemorial, in which a few along the way, including Carl Gustav Jung, have spent time to study and to try and make sense of. Sir James George Frazier and his analysis of, you know, the hero myth and these kinds of things in books like The Golden Bough. You know, there are little stepping stones along the way that seem to point to the way that modern humans orient themselves through myth and symbol that are archetypes that are representative of where we come from and what we've done along the way, and the way that the mind orients itself in relation to our environment and others and what we perceive of reality. This is a much deeper question. And so I think it's, you know, I'm like you, Jim, I applaud a scientific study that seeks to to classify and try to categorize some of these experiences, which often do occur in relation to what we would call NDEs or the near-death experience, which I believe Dr. Raymond Moody actually coined that term. Moody was no slouch and no stranger to the sorts of mythic parallels that we see, and in fact, it had been his own studies of modern archaeology as it relates to antiquity and the kinds of things we find in the writings of Homer, Strabo, and others, and Herodotus, of course, that led to his clinical a practitioner's kind of approach, because what Moody was doing with his psychomantium, the term derived from the Greek necromantion, I mean, he was really doing grief counseling. So it was really more of a counseling thing, but still that advances, I think, to an extent, our psychological knowledge. A lot of people would call it really woo-woo, but what he was seeking to do was to see if he could induce experiences where people had communication with the deceased, which is very much like these NDEs. And having coined that term, I'm sure he was well aware of that. But I asked Dr. Moody once when I met him at a dinner, I said, Dr. Moody, do you think that these experiences that people are having are actual spirits of loved ones that they're seeing, dead, ghosts? And he said, no, I think that these things stem from within the mind. Dr. Moody told me that. And so I think that, again, we look at that in the broader context of what you bring up with this story. It seems very clear to me that we have a lot of questions about the mind and the way that we utilize myth and symbol to orient ourselves and have done, you know, since humans became a conscious species. And I think that, you know, we've got a long way to go and a lot to learn. And we're not going to do that if we keep, you know, shunning what appear to be what we might call at times paranormal experiences from scientific study. We need to study them scientifically, and we don't need to make up answers and make, you know, prejudgments and suppositions. We just need to try and study and understand and accumulate data so that as we learn more, we can come to those determinations later on down the road. We're not close enough, I don't think, yet to make that determination, but we're getting there at least.
Well, one determination that I could make is from time to time, Micah, I enjoy some nice seafood, you know, some crab and certainly some lobster. But if I got my hands on this guy you're going to tell us about now, I think that I might have to step away from the table. And, you know, this is maybe not paranormal, but certainly weird and strange and interesting. And I love these kind of scientific stories you always bring to the table. Tell us about this this giant lobster.
A giant lobster that I'm going to strangely...
My mouth is watering as we speak.
Well, I could go for a nice buttered lobster tail myself right now. But I'm going to strangely tie this in a little with the Loch Ness Monster. What we're talking about here, it is something that at one time, specifically 480 million years ago, would have been, I believe, the largest creature probably that inhabited our oceans. It's also probably the largest among ancestors of modern-day lobsters. But this creature, 480 million years ago when it existed, first of all, it didn't look much like a lobster, and also it was only 7 feet long. But it swam, and it was, again, you know, a lobster-like sea creature. It had flaps rather than, well, you know, what we see with, you know, with the claws on lobsters. It had these flaps on its belly and back that it used along a long kind of a, almost, you know, a segmented kind of an insect-like body to swim along, and it fed on plankton and the like. So, again, this thing, according to Peter Van Roy, who's an archaeologist at Yale University who spoke on this, he said it would have dwarfed anything else at the time, being twice as big as the next biggest animal at that time. They were absolutely massive, at least for 480 million years ago. But, you know, when we study creatures in the fossil record, no longer existent, but that carry over at least through the fossil record into the present, we can study these. There's a little known animal that in a very strange way sort of ties in with that long history of the Loch Ness Monster. A creature very much like, maybe even in some way or shape or form related to this giant lobster-like creature, which I believe the scientific name for is Idriocassis benomuli.
Hmm. And this, you can say that again.
Yeah, well, actually, maybe I'll just skip out. Idriocassis benomuli, I believe, is the name. But the Tully monster, a totally different species, little known, vaguely resemblant of a plesiosaur, but more akin to a planarian, I guess, or a worm-like creature, was an animal that once lived in the oceans. And by virtue of its general shape, it sort of matches, albeit being more worm or slug or snail-like, it matches the general shape of what some have reported appears in Loch Ness Monster. And a strange theory that was, I guess, probably around the 1960s or 70s that was posited in relation to what creature might inhabit Loch Ness was that there was a giant Tully monster.
Huh.
A creature otherwise only known through the fossil record. Have you ever seen a Tully monster before?
I have not.
It's, I mean, they do look kind of like a little plesiosaur, but again, more akin to a snail or a slug, really. So it's kind of strange, but you know, there are a lot of interesting things that we find in the fossil record, and it just goes to show in the long term on planet Earth the diversity of life that has existed here. And without, I think, leaping into the realm of the truly uncanny, I think we could at least say that there have been far stranger creatures to have come and gone on planet Earth than are reported in the modern annals of cryptozoology. And to me, I don't think that it's necessarily too hard to believe that there might be really, truly strange things that might still exist out there, because we've seen far stranger that have come and gone, and we know they existed.
Well, truth is stranger than fiction. But the truth is, Micah, we've done it again. We've reached the end of another Paranormal Report, and I just want to tell folks, we have not forgotten about the video side over at ParanormalReport.tv and on YouTube. We plan on putting out some more videos next week. Frankly, I got sidetracked with some stuff. It's not Micah's fault. So,
there it goes, taking the blame again.
The falling on the sword here. But we will get back with more videos next week, so stay tuned for that. But stay tuned for everything we do. I know Micah always has a cornucopia of quality content over at Grayling Report. Tell us what's going on this week, Micah.
Well, lots are going on at Grayling Report. We always have, you know, just a wonderful time with all the stuff that we're producing. Today, the second edition of the subscriber-only CryptoCast that I do with Dakota Waddell, my co-host, we're going to be recording that here, taping in mere minutes following the wrap of this session. And so for those who are Grayling X subscribers, we have, of course, a free hour and a half to hour and 45-minute long podcast we put out each week called The Grayling Report. But as a subscriber, people will not only get the new CryptoCast, and we're going to be talking about, again, the ethics of whether or not a creature like a Bigfoot should be killed. We're going to be looking at a strange story of a cave creature from Tennessee, a lot of really, really weird stuff, which, you know, a lot of it I take with a grain of salt, Jim, but I'm never going to rule out possibilities. That's one thing that we don't do. At the Grayling Report, we just try to look at these mysteries in a serious and sober way and as scientifically as possible. And I don't think it's unscientific to allow for the possibility that there are a lot of weird things out there. I'm preaching to the choir here, though, because I know that you're somebody who does a lot of that. And what's weird going on over there in your world this week?
I don't know that it's weird, but it's different. The big thing now, of course, just released three paranormal podcasts of various stripes: The Campfire, The Paranormal Podcast, and one of our UFO encounter shows on the plus side with our mutual friend Peter Robbins yesterday. So still very strong on the paranormal. But I have a new project I want to tell people about that's not paranormal, but if you're like me, a fan of classic TV, you may just be interested in. And it's called...
I knew it. You're doing a TV dinner podcast, right?
Not exactly. Although that sounds kind of good right now. I'm kind of hungry. Anyway, TV You Grew Up With, it's a podcast dedicated to classic TV. Now, I misspent a lot of my youth watching classic TV, so I thought, how could I put all that knowledge to good use? And I came up with this idea, and basically it is interviews with people who made the best TV ever. Now, to start out, we've got two great guests, Dick DiBartolo, who's Mad's Maddest Writer, the Giz Whiz over on the Twit Network, but he was also the creative genius who shaped that famous game show, The Match Game, that I grew up with. And really, he said, for example, he came up with questions like, Mary liked to pour gravy on John's blank. That was the idea. He turned it into a comedy show and saved the show from being canceled and won for a long, long run on network and syndication. He was our first guest, a nice, great guy. Then we had on our second episode, Don Most, who played Ralph Malph on Happy Days. And we've got a lot of great guests coming up. Judy Norton, who is Mary Ellen on The Waltons. And the next show is going to be Richard Hatch, who played Captain Apollo on the original Battlestar Galactica. So we're really excited about that show. You can find it at tvyougrewupwith.com, or you can find it over at iTunes as well. And if you do go over there and check it out, please rate and review it, because in these early days of a podcast, it really kind of shapes it. And if you can get the popularity up at the beginning, it is a tremendous help. And if you miss that window of opportunity, then you might not do so well. So please, if you like it, if you like these shows that we do, and you like my other paranormal podcast, do me a favor. If you like classic TV, go check it out, rate and review it as soon as you can, because it's a huge help. And I'm really excited about that. And one last thing, and I'm sorry I'm going on and on. I have changed my Twitter handle, Micah, from that complicated one that I used to have, to The Jim Harold, simply The Jim Harold. Now, no problem. If you already follow me on Twitter, you will follow over, so you don't need to do anything. You'll still get my tweets. It'll just be from The Jim Harold. And you were the inspiration for that. You had a great Twitter handle, Micah Hanks. And I'm like, well, I'm not smart, but I'm smart enough to know that my jumble of alphabet was too complicated for people. So it's pretty simple now. The Jim Harold over on Twitter.
There you go. I'm glad I'm a positive influence. And hey,
inspiration.
Your new show may not be about TV dinners, but frankly, I think that classic TV, that sounds like fun. And really, on the whole, it's probably more appetizing than a TV dinner anyway.
I think it's a culinary delight in terms of podcasts, I hope. Well, certainly we hope that you found delight in this program and that you'll tune in next week. Certainly go over to jimherold.com/TPR sign up and submit your videos and photos, paranormal style, of things you'd like us to feature on the videos. And we thank you so much for tuning in, and we'll talk to you next time on the Paranormal Report. Have a great week, Micah.
Yes, you too, Jim, and all of you out there. Have a wonderful week. Videos to follow soon, and we'll talk to you next time.
Yeah, several lights flashing all around it and underneath.
I know ghosts are real.
You've been talking about Sasquatches and Yetis.
Yellow, orange objects straight ahead.
This is the Paranormal Report.